Our second case this morning is United States against Diaz. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Kathleen Purcell, and my co-counsel is Lieutenant Kathleen Cadluck, representing the appellant, Nancy Diaz. I'd like to start with the questions surrounding 18 U.S.C. Section 793 D and E, and specifically the elements of scienter and national security. We have a well-developed body of federal case law regarding this statute and its requirements. And the federal courts tell us that Section 793 D and E require a genuine threat to national security as an element, require willfulness, meaning bad purpose to break or disregard the law. And at least in cases such as the one at bar, where the information clause under Section 793 D is charged, they require bad faith. And that information
counsel isn't a tardy dispositive as far as we're concerned?
No, it isn't, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, a tardy did not involve the information clause, which the federal courts have looked at as being different. The information clause and disclosure of information is specifically modified by the provision that the possessor have reason to know that it could harm the United States or advantage a foreign country.
Well, when one sends classified information to a person not entitled to receive it, what is that if not exactly what the statute says?
That's a question that the courts have addressed quite directly, Your Honor. And if you look at the Morrison decision, if you look at the Rosen decision, if you look at the Smith decision, you'll find that there is no strict liability here for willful, even, disclosure of classified information.
Okay. Was he not briefed when he got there on the content of this information, on these data, and their status, and national interest in this material?
He was, Your Honor, and the government was allowed to introduce every bit of that evidence. The problem here is not what the government was allowed to introduce, it's what the defense was barred from introducing. Because in 1957, Congress was presented and requested by the Commission on Government Security to pass a law that would make willful disclosure of classified information in and of itself a criminal offense. And Congress said no.
Well, you're arguing from inaction on the part of Congress 50 years before. What's he trying to say here? Is he trying to say he has a legal excuse?
It's not a formal justification.
It's not a formal justification.
If the statute requires, as the federal courts have held, genuine threat to national security, bad purpose.
Who's the judge of whether it's a genuine threat to national security?
The members. The jury, Your Honor. Mm. And classification status is not dispositive, because to say that would be to establish a strict liability offense and to create a conclusive presumption, which is not only generally disfavoring the law, but which has been specifically disapproved as to this statute. So what we have here is evidence that the defendant sought to introduce and the court barred completely that would have shown, one, that there in fact was no genuine threat, that the only threat was that habeas corpus attorneys would see this material. Two, that this accused had no real reasonable cause to believe.
So what he wants, assuming he could get in everything he wanted to get in.
Yes, sir.
What he wants to show is basically that it was silly to classify this material.
Well, the classification status, of course, was in question and was highly disputed at trial.
Well, but that's not before us, is it?
What he wants to show is that he had reason to believe that there was no threat here.
Okay. What he wanted to show was that he could substitute his judgment for the judgment of the relevant authorities in determining the harm or lack thereof from the illegitimate dissemination of this material. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. What I'm saying is that he was entitled to show that regardless of whether the manner in which he proceeded was appropriate, and he conceded wrongdoing in the manner, the mens rea for this particular statute, and there was plenty else that the government could charge and that they did charge, but that the mens rea for this statute and the genuine threat to national security required for this statute was lacking.
I'm confused, though. Earlier, were you arguing that he was convicted on the basis that this stuff was classified, or is your essential argument that, notwithstanding the fact that the members were presented with the question of genuine threat, they did not get to review it with the benefit of this additional testimony that you sought to proffer?
Both, Your Honor, because if you look at the rulings below and the discussion below, and even if you look at the government's brief on appeal, what you will find is that the government's position here, which the military judge adopted, was that knowing disclosure of classified information satisfies and concludes the discussion of whether the defendant had the requisite intent under Section 793. Additionally, as an evidentiary matter, as to genuine threat, as to mens rea, as to bad faith, this evidence, which would have shown two critical things. One, that the disclosure of this identifying information flowed directly from the United States Supreme Court decision in Russell versus Bush and the district court decision implementing it. The defendant was on the team for the district court case. He was at the Guantanamo end to present and develop justifications for the government positions in this case. But the second thing is, and I'll use the oath of the officer as the critical example. It's an oath with which we're all familiar, and he promises to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Why does that negate a genuine threat?
It negates.
It may give him an alternative duty, but I don't understand how that negates a genuine threat.
The logical flow of the information from the Supreme Court decision negates the genuine threat, Your Honor. Because if it was required by the Supreme Court decision, particularly under the circumstances involved here, where it was sent only to the lead attorney on the habeas corpus matters, then where's the genuine threat? The only threat from this disclosure that the government was able to come up with was that additional habeas corpus attorneys might see it.
Well, I understand that argument, but I don't understand why your oath of office negates whether something has a genuine threat or not.
As to the oath of office, it goes to the question of whether the willfulness and whether the bad faith is present.
Do you deny the act was willful? He knew what he was doing, and he knew the consequences thereof. He didn't do it in a fit of absent-mindedness. And he certainly wasn't misled.
Willfulness is one of those terms, Your Honor, that means different things in different statutes. And in this statute, what the federal courts have said consistently is that willful in this statute means bad purpose to disobey or disregard the law. And in that definition of willful, which is an element of this offense...
And what's the authority for that?
The authority for that is Morrison, United States versus Morrison, the Fourth Circuit decision. All three of the judges, both the lead opinion and the two concurrences, agreed that what saved the conviction and the statute was in part the fact that the trial judge had instructed that it required a bad purpose to break the law. Also, United States versus Rosen, which speaks to the same
being the reason to believe, blah, blah, blah.
Maybe not, Your Honor. I mean, let's look at that reason to believe language. And I would invite you, in looking at it, to also look at Gorin versus United States, the Supreme Court decision.
Which also referred back to the bad purpose being reason to believe.
Correct. But which also...
would rather than could. But
the language there, but the reasoning of Gorin applies directly, Your Honor, because what Gorin said and what commentators and courts have complained of about Section 793D and E consistently is that these are vague and overbroad statutes. They have to be saved. They have to be salvaged by judicial action.
They don't contain, we're talking about 793D here, is, and admittedly 794A and 793A contain more explicit scienter language than the statutes at issue here, correct?
They do. They contain the is to be used language.
Right.
But they are.
Is Gorin really saying? In the first place, of course, the statute's been amended very substantially since Gorin.
Still suffers from vagus nerve breath, Your Honor.
Is Gorin saying any more than, is bad faith under Gorin any more than, anything more than willfulness?
Well, it has to be partly because otherwise we've got redundancy in this statute.
Oh, the Supreme Court is never redundant?
Certainly they would agree with you.
No.
But the second thing, Your Honor, is that in Gorin we have the court actually talking in the language of motive and saying that as to bad faith, motive, even in the classic sense, is relevant. So clearly then that's something more than willful, at least as you've defined it, or even as reason to believe. But the second thing is, if anything is vague, it is there reason to believe something could harm the United States? Let me give you an example that's not quite as loaded. If the National Weather Service tells me that there's a high likely chance of rain, is it relevant that I look out the window and it's sunny and clear? I'm not saying it's dispositive, but that the members had a right to decide and the defense had a right to put on its case. And what the military judge's decisions did was to read those elements out of the statute for purposes of the defense case.
Counsel, for with respect to the bad faith argument, is that separate from the willfulness or is that integrated with it? And could you explain to me how in the statute those two fit together?
Certainly, Your Honor. The bad faith, meaning intent to injure, or what the courts have found to be virtually inevitable injury, is a separate element. It is an element that some of the federal courts have suggested it occurs only in those cases that are charged under the information clause of Section 793D and E.
And so what particular words trigger or relate to intent to injure in the statute?
For the courts, in order to cure vagueness and overbreadth, the language that triggers it is information the possessor has, when the possessor has reason to believe that it could be used to harm the United States or advantage a foreign country. And the reason is that without that, both that phrase and the statute overall is both vague and vastly overbroad.
Is it possible for good purpose, at least a subjective good purpose, to coexist with reason to believe as to injury? That is, for an individual to do their own balancing test and to conclude that the disclosure of the information outweighs the potential for harm to the United States.
It's theoretically possible, Your Honor.
Then how do we deal with that?
That's not this case, okay. for two reasons. One is that as to the particular evidence here, we have not only the accused's subjective state of mind, but we have the objective indicia. The Supreme Court decision, the district court decision, the government resistance to providing information not based on national security, but that we don't want to provide it, and the justification they ultimately came up with was detainees' purported privacy, but clearly not national security.
Did Russell prohibit the government from responding in the following manner? We, the government, will comply with the decision by providing government-furnished counsel to all of the detainees. And we are also going to do that in a manner in which we're going to ask the courts to not release the names of the detainees in any of the proceedings before them. Now, they didn't do that, but did Rossall itself preclude that? Was that still a viable option at the time that this disclosure was made?
Not at the time the disclosure was made, Your Honor. At the time the disclosure was made, the government position for how they were going to deal with the detainees' right to habeas corpus was that either they could represent themselves or they could fill out a form which would be sent to the American Bar Association. And what you have and what was excluded was an ability for the defense to present evidence explaining three things. One, why the need for the identifying information flowed directly from the Supreme Court decision. Two, why the fact and the circumstances of the government obstruction of access to the detainees in terms of direct access to counsel and also of information necessary either to get to the detainees or to their families, which would enable habeas corpus on behalf of the families for the detainee, and three, that the defendant knew all that.
And does this go to which of the three aspects, the genuine threat, the willfulness, or the bad faith?
The flow of the information from the Supreme Court and the government obstruction goes to all three, Your Honor. The oath that was questioned goes to the desire to uphold the law, the intent to uphold the law, rather than a bad purpose to break the law. But the flow of the information shows there's no real threat, shows this accused had no reason to believe there was a real threat, and shows that he didn't act with a bad purpose. So that goes to all three.
Can I ask three questions, please?
Please, Your Honor, let me...
Is it just by chance, based on the questions from the bench, that you focused on the genuine threat in the first issue? Is that your strongest argument? Is that your, just from your perspective, which is your best issue, or is your view they're all wonderful? But you haven't mentioned the other two issues, and I just want to make sure that that's because you think this is the key to the case, or is that just because that's what we were talking about up here?
The other two issues in the case, you mean one of the Article 133
right.
issues? I think that those issues are more straightforward, if you will, and they're an area with which this Court is quite familiar, whereas this is a federal statute that I don't imagine comes too often.
I don't want to use your – that was a fair answer. What did the judge get wrong? You said earlier that the judge – or at least I thought you said that the judge indicated that classification proved genuine threat and remove that issue from the jury. I may not have heard you correctly, but let me ask you, with respect to the judge's instructions, what specifically, with reference to his instructions, did he get wrong based on your issue one?
And counsel, and your, although your time is about to expire, please take the time that you need to answer Judge Baker's question.
Thank you very much. By the time we get to the instructions, Your Honor, if you look at the discussion on the instructions, the military judge explains that for instructions purposes, he has borrowed from the federal model instructions. So he got it at least partially right on the instructions.
Okay, I'm interested in what he got wrong.
So he instructed that there had to be a real potential damage.
Do you have them before you, and can you cite specifically to the sentences that you think contain legal error? Or you can do it on rebuttal, by the way. I'd be happy to, that's a fair way to do it, too.
I don't have in front of me his instruction as to what was national defense, but he did say in his instructions that the information was related to national defense and that he quoted the language of the statute, basically, that the accused had reason to believe that the information could be used, etc., and that the accused willfully transmitted, and he gave the willful instruction from the federal cases. The problem is he had already excluded all the relevant evidence. So the instructions don't help you, Your Honor, because he didn't instruct at all on good faith, on bad faith, of course. But even as to the other elements, although he instructed satisfactorily, he had already done the damage by skewing the case.
So you're back to the evidence that was excluded. And just if that evidence had come in, could the government have brought in the evidence of the TJAG's regulation indicating what you should do if you don't think the law is being followed?
I think they could have, been.
That would have
been. But the members would have had the whole circumstances in front of them, and that's the point. If I may conclude, unless the court has
you'll have,
other
you'll questions. Have an opportunity on rebuttal, counsel.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, may I please the court. Appellant's proffered evidence demonstrated what induced him to send classified information to a private attorney. Therefore, it was irrelevant because, one, this section of the Espionage Act did not have a heightened scienter requirement that would permit certain types of motive evidence. And two, regardless of the level of scienter in this section of the Espionage Act, this particular mode of evidence was irrelevant.
What about the 133 charge? Doesn't 133 go to the issue of honor?
Yes, Your Honor. The elements of the 133 charge are more permissive, and the government's response would be it was only irrelevant under MRE 403 because it would have been extremely misleading or confusing to the members to hear that these two charges are so similar that they are merged for sentencing purposes, yet you're going to consider this evidence for one charge and you must disregard it for another. That would have been so confusing, as these offenses are so similar, that the military judge was correct in excluding that evidence.
So I hear you saying it was relevant, logically relevant, but only excludable on 403 grounds.
Your Honor, the government would concede that it is relevant. The government's best answer would have been it was inadmissible under MRE 403.
Because honor can be defined as including one's sense of ethical duty, right? Ethical conduct.
Correct, Your Honor. Turning back to 793, unless Your Honor would like to continue discussing 133, this court has distinguished the difference between motive and intent by citing various criminal law treatises. And to paraphrase, motive is the inducement to act, and intent is the determination to act. Appellant's evidence, and the best place to look to determine whether this was indeed motive evidence or whether it bore on intent, is his own assistant defense counsel's opening statement, in which he characterized the evidence, which drew an objection that was sustained by the military judge, was the evidence which showed a crisis of conscience, a moral dilemma, or conflicting duties, as commonly thought at 124 in the joint appendix. This all demonstrates his apparent conflict, the conflict the same as existed in Hewitt Vaughn, where the accused wanted to demonstrate compliance with international law and disregard of the UCMJ. That's exactly what the appellant here sought to do, comply with his apparent reading of Rasul v. Bush in the Constitution, permitting him to disregard the Espionage Act. Now, having determined that this is motive evidence, let's shift to talk about 793D specifically. The difference and where appellant's reliance on Gorin is in its place comes from Judge Stuckey's questions about is and could. In Gorin, 794A, it's reason to believe the information is to be used to injure the United States. 793D is reason to believe the information could be used to harm injure the United States. The could shifts something from subjective to objective. If it is harm the United States, the government must prove the accused intended actual harm. And the instruction here, which concedes was properly given, is potential harm. The best way to illustrate this point, the best authority for this, is the Morrison decision, the district court's decision in Morrison. An appellant's reliance on the Fourth Circuit case in Morrison to say that there is no bad faith requirement is curious, because the Fourth Circuit expressly adopted the district court's decision, which notes this difference between subjective and objective, and excluded evidence of patriotism and said that motive was irrelevant. There is no broad federal authority or anything. Well, there's no broad federal authority for appellants to meet the standard requirement. Appellant's only authority are two district court decisions, Smith and Rosen. Smith, both of which are wrongly decided. Smith is wrongly decided only in a very narrow sense, in that it seemingly read the 794 and 793 elements together. And it's very distinguishable from this case, because Smith dealt with an apparent belief that he had actual authority to release the information, an ignorance defense. And that was entirely permissible. And appellant, indeed, in this case, offered an ignorance defense. In Rosen, the district court goes further and says, indeed, a bad faith requirement is required under 793D. But when the Fourth Circuit takes this case up on appeal, the Fourth Circuit notes explicitly, we don't choose to address this issue because it's law of the case. They say the government attempts to inappropriately piggyback the challenge of the trial judge's instructions requiring a bad faith claim. The Fourth Circuit is in Morrison made clear that there is no bad faith element. Indeed, the trial judge's instructions in Morrison had no bad faith element. It said bad purpose. Bad purpose is very different from bad faith. Bad purpose is synonymous with willfulness.
By the way, when I want to go back to the 133 issue, but I don't want to interrupt you. You seem to be on a roll.
No, yeah. Well, the 133, if you aren't persuaded by the government's position that it's...
Well, first of all, the only... You have one sentence in your brief that raises the 403 argument.
Yes, sir.
On page 25, you say, faced with that quandary, although the military judge did not rule on 403 grounds, he could have excluded appellant's preferred proffered evidence due to the confusion it would have caused the members. Now, presumably, it's the government that chose to charge both, of course, so they're creating the confusion. But what is confusing again? With respect to the specific things, the oath of an officer is confusing to members who are officers, and therefore what? They just don't understand their oath, or?
No, Your Honor. It's confusing because it is motive evidence. It is evidence that demonstrates that the accused consciously chose to disregard the Espionage Act, the charged crime.
I'm arguing 133.
Yes, Your Honor. But,
I'm but not that, arguing it. I'm asking about it, but... The 133 has to do with whether you're acting in part in an honorable or dishonorable way. And presumably, in the abstract, one could disclose classified information in an honorable way. You have information that Pearl Harbor is about to be attacked, everybody ignores you, you go ahead and release it to people who are not authorized to have it. My guess is if that had happened, that person would not have been prosecuted. So in theory, at least, it might be possible to act in an honorable way while mishandling technically classified information. Do you agree with that?
I do.
I don't agree this is that case, by the way.
I agree, Your Honor. The confusion lies in the similarity between 793D and Article 133. This is the same conduct charged different ways. So the confusion lies in we're charging the same acts two different
ways. Same conduct, okay, but it has separate elements.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government's...
The appellant's not permitted to introduce evidence that negates a separate element? He's stuck arguing just one charge?
Your Honor, the government's only answer I can give you is 403. Okay. And our fallback position would still be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because if you take all of the appellant's evidence and take it to be true, it only bears on the names of the detainees. Appellant was really charged with the document, Prosecution Exhibit 3, which we can't talk about, but it had columns of information. On one side, you have the detainees' names. So Razulmi Bush, his oath, his ethics, all of which only spoke to the left side of this document, the detainees' names. None of it related, and the appellant, so the defense counsel concedes this in the motion hearing. He says, our defense to the gobbledygook, he called it, the alphanumeric source code, which remained classified, is ignorance. So, Your Honor, even if all of that information came in, it's still harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because it does not bear in one instance on the classified information which he is actually charged with releasing.
And they were merged for sentencing anyway, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So even if, yes, Your Honor. Turning back to 793D for a moment.
Why would that make it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? He's got multiple convictions.
Well, Your Honor, it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the evidence would be inadmissible, even taken to be true.
No, but my question is with respect to merger for sentence. What bearing does that have on findings?
For that purposes, Your Honor, this court would dismiss the effective charge, in this case the 133, and the sentence would be ineffective. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. But the government's...
Because we'd have to do that to make it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
If, Your Honor, if this court doesn't agree with the government's position, that it would still be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because all of that evidence did not relate to the full internment security numbers and the correlations with the categories and the columns. And I'd invite this court's attention to Mr. Rester's testimony in the classified section of the record of trial, which begins around page 1400 for... an explanation of why that information was classified.
I understand.
You don't mean classified, do you? Or do you mean classified? Information that poses a genuine threat to U.S. national security?
Yes, in this, it was classified.
It's a question, not a statement. Do you really mean classified, or do you mean information that poses a genuine threat?
The latter. Okay. The latter. The classified nature just merely it informs the accused about whether he should have released this information.
With respect to harmless beyond a reasonable doubt on findings, are you changing your previous answer to Judge Baker's question about whether some of the evidence that the appellant sought to have admitted could have gone to whether he was acting honorably or not?
No, Your Honor, the government's position remains the same. It was inadmissible under 403. If not that, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because it didn't bear on the classified sources and methods which were released in the columns on the right side of Prosecution Exhibit 3. And then even if not that, it would still, this court would dismiss the Article 133 charge and it wouldn't affect the sentence. Turning back to 793D, appellant confused.
What case stands for the proposition that 403 applies when something gets put into the too hard box as far as instructing on separate charges that the government chooses to bring?
Your Honor, I don't have any case law other than the language of 403 itself, which says confusing and misleading to the members. And unless there are any further questions on that, I'll turn back to 793D briefly. The appellant confuses willful and bad faith. They're not the same thing. Willful permits an ignorance defense. It permits the accused to put forth evidence he did not intentionally, did not know of the Espionage Act, did not know he was prevented from releasing this information.
Well, did you say that they tried to lodge that?
They absolutely did, Your Honor. They had a defense expert they called for exactly that purpose, to show that the evidence wasn't classified, or there were no labels on the classification that were apparent. And appellant disputes this in the government's brief because if you look at Prosecution Exhibit 3, there are no security banners in the traditional sense that the court probably is thinking of, in a bright red on the top and bottom. But there is an icon on the left-hand side of the screen that says security banner, with which, and Mr. Cates testifies to this in the classified portion, if you click on that, that would give the security banner. So, there, and the classification just goes to Judge Baker's question to inform whether the accused was knowledgeable about the release of this information.
Okay, well, and the accused had been using this same computer for months?
Yes, Your Honor, he had been.
And this thing pops up every time you use it?
Your Honor, it's an icon on the left that he could click on affirmatively, which would display.
Okay, did he argue that never in the time that he had used this computer over the months he was at Gitmo, he'd ever clicked on this thing, or what?
The accused didn't testify on the merits, Your Honor, but he had a defense expert that testified that the information was should have been conspicuously labeled. And because it was not, he was ignorant of the fact that he should have protected this information. That was essentially his defense at trial, which was a proper evidence to rebut the willful element, that he was ignorant of the fact that this stuff was not.
Okay, so at trial he argued not that he substituted his judgment from superior motives. He argued that he was just a poor schlemiel who didn't know anything about the status of this information.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's precisely why the evidence that he now argues should have been admitted does not bear at all on whether he would have been acquitted, because his only acknowledged defense to the actual national defense material, the classified sources and methods, was ignorance. That was his defense, rebutting properly the willful element. There was no bad faith requirement that he was permitted to enter into evidence because there is no motive that would be admissible under this statute because there is no bad faith requirement.
My recollection, counsel, is several minutes ago you quoted with approval a case in which a bad purpose requirement was employed, and how do we employ that analysis here in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Bad purpose is not synonymous with bad faith. The bad purpose comes from Morrison. The Morrison case, they instructed properly that, as the military judge did here, an act done voluntarily and intentionally with specific intent to do something the law forbids, that is, with a bad purpose, either to disobey or disregard the law. And there's a Third Circuit case, Irwin, which is not cited in the government's brief. It's at 546 F. 2nd, 1048, Your Honor. And that indicates that bad purpose is a synonym for willful or intentional violation of a known legal duty.
So bad purpose is not the opposite of good purpose, then? Or is understanding of what the defense wants to argue here, is arguing here, is whether it's good faith, bad faith, good purpose, bad purpose, that they all are in the same box as far as the evidence that was excluded, that he couldn't show a bad purpose, he couldn't show a good purpose here, therefore any instruction on the bad purpose was inadequate.
Yes, Your Honor, but that instruction, when you read it in context, bad purpose, that is, to disregard or disobey the law. Well, what is the law? The law is not the law in an esoteric sense, a law of the laws of Congress or the laws of mankind. The law is the Espionage Act. So he could put forth evidence, I didn't know the Espionage Act, I wasn't aware that this information was classified or national defense material. That's how he could properly rebut that element, say he didn't have a bad purpose, Your Honor. But he cannot say, because this is referring to the Espionage Act, he cannot say, I'm following the Constitution. I'm following Missouri v. Bush, which permits me to disregard the Espionage Act. That is not proper. That is precisely what only a bad faith requirement would theoretically allow, but it wouldn't in this case because of the nature of information he sought to admit, which only challenged the names and not the classified.
My understanding of the defense argument is that he wanted to use this information, in effect, to show that he had a good purpose, and that in having a good purpose, it would not violate the Espionage Act, and therefore he wouldn't be disregarding it. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, the good purpose would be a good purpose not to harm the United States. It's not a good purpose, I had a purpose, which I think was good. It's a good purpose, I didn't intend harm to the United States. The standard would be reason to believe it could harm the United States. And again, this is objective, not subjective, but even if we were to presume it were subjective for the sake of argument, he still would only be able to put forth evidence that the nature of the information, the recipient of the information's purpose was not to harm the United States. That would be a proper rebuttal to that element. He would not be able to say, I'm following a different law which permits me to disregard this law. That is quintessential motive evidence, which would be irrelevant regardless of the scienter requirement, the scienter level under this statute.
And with respect to the objective harm, and again, I don't want to go into any classified information here, but is the government relying at all on names, or are you relying solely on classified information here?
Well, Your Honor, the government would be relying on Mr. Rester's testimony about the sources and methods that were revealed through the columns of information on the right-hand side of Prosecution Exhibit 3, which tied together revealed classified sources and methods, Your Honor. The names, actually, in January of 2005, were only FOUO. They were only for, and this can be found in Mr. Cates' testimony in the unclassified section. Page number's escaping me at the moment. But Mr. Cates testified that the names were FOUO, and the sources and methods were actually the classified information, which the government contends is what he's actually charged with releasing.
So that is, what's the government's position, or has the government taken position, that if names alone were revealed on a plain piece of paper, would that have supported a charge in this case?
It probably would not, Your Honor, because the names alone, it would be difficult for the government to maintain its burden to show this was national defense material or could harm the United States when the government itself is indicating that it's only FOUO at the time. Turning briefly to the Article 133 charge, in the military judge's rejection of the guilty plea, the standard there is so high, it's arbitrary. And here, the military judge gave a reasoned rejection. By giving a reason, it didn't even have to be the correct reason. It needed a thoughtful reason, and it wasn't arbitrary in rejecting the accused's offer to plead guilty. For those reasons, the military judge should be affirmed. The rulings and the ruling below should be affirmed. The evidence was irrelevant under both 793D and Article 133 for different reasons, and the military judge did not act arbitrarily.
Is it possible to describe the right column in words of English that would describe to an ordinary person what we're talking about?
Your Honor, it's the tying together the headers to the columns and the sources. And
this is not a trick question. It's a question about whatever we write, it'd be helpful to communicate in English rather than hieroglyphics,
Your Honor,
the issues are.
In an unclassified way, it would be difficult to explain, I'll concede, Your Honor. I could just invite this Court's attention to Mr. Rester's testimony as to...
If he said it, we can say it.
Well, Your Honor, he said it in the unclassified section, and I see that I'm out of time shortly if I answer the question briefly.
You can briefly answer the question.
He said it reveals classified sources and methods, and I think that would be sufficient, Your Honor.
Although not revealing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you have a brief concluding statement, you may make it now.
This court should affirm for the reasons discussed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes.
I'd like to start with the prosecution's closing argument, which they began with the following statement, that the accused, Lieutenant Commander Diaz, when he took the actions he took, was not working for the commanding general, was not working for the U.S. of A., but was working, quote, for his own personal agenda. The evidence that was systematically excluded would have rebutted that. The prosecution went on to argue, and I quote, "You haven't heard from anybody that this information, namely the identifying information, was improperly or illegally withheld." And the only reason the prosecution could make that argument unrebutted was because that evidence had been excluded. Counsel on his argument said that the question here is good purpose not to harm the United States. And that's an important part of the point, because that is the objective of this statute, Section 793D, and it's what the courts have looked to in part to flesh out these elements. And it distinguishes cases like Hewitt Vaughn and other cases that have classic motive evidence. Hewitt Vaughn was a conscientious objector, because as this court and others have pointed out, in those cases, the defendant's motive, no matter how laudable, does not speak to the harm that the statute is trying to preclude. In fact, it reinforces it. That kind of desire for mankind, belief that the war is immoral, tends to demonstrate that, in fact, there was an intent to harm the national security, or there was an intent in sabotage cases to impede the military effort. That's not the case here. So we have definiteness, we have predictability, we have objective indicia in this case. And what you will find, I think, as you look at the military judge, at the government argument, and I'd ask the court to check itself, Section 793 does not criminalize willful disclosure of classified information. And what the military judge did in this case was, through all of his rulings, to interpret Section 793D so that if the members found that there was no disclosure of classified information, that ended the question.
I still ask you, where do you get that out of the instructions that the members were given?
He did not express
in the instructions to members that says classified equals harm to the United States.
And you're right, Your Honor, in the sense that that was not explicitly instructed, but it was the thread that ran through the entire way that the military.
And what are your best three examples that you hope we're reading when we consider this issue?
I'd ask you to read the arguments surrounding the motion in limine. I'd ask you to
particular pages you draw our attention to, or just have at it.
I don't have them with me, Your
That's
Honor.
That's okay. We're happy. We just want to give you the opportunity to highlight if you wish.
Certainly. If you look at the government's brief, for example, at page 2, at page 23, and at page 28, you'll see that that's the argument, is that classification resolves the issue. May I conclude, Your Honor?
You may give a brief concluding statement.
Thank you. The question as to Section 793 is who decides? Do the members decide, and do they get to have a record that will enable them to decide? And it is whether this federal criminal statute means the same thing in a court-martial as in a federal court. Overall, what happened in this case was that the judge created a one-way street. It was a street in which the government could go down full force and the defense was not even allowed to enter. And that was true on each of the errors. I thank you, and I request reversal.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. on Thursday morning.